You're listening to KHOL. This is Jackson Unpacked, our weekly show featuring reporting and interviews on local news, music, and culture. I'm news director Kyle Mackey. Before we get into today's episode, our small team is really excited to announce that Jackson Unpacked is now available as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Subscribing to and rating the show and telling your friends and neighbors about it helps support Jackson's only nonprofit newsroom. You can also do more to support the show and the station by becoming a member of KHOL today at 891KHOL.org. Okay, now coming up on today's show, a look at what the initial 2020 U.S. Census data released last week mean for Wyoming and Idaho.
To be very frank, I think the state could get out of its own way.
Plus, KHOL Spanish language reporter Alicia Unger brings us the story of one local family's recent experience in the U.S. immigration system and a partial reunion just in time for Mother's Day.
Her son is still in a detention center in Mississippi.
But first, Jackson Hole High School principal, Scott Crisp, was recently named Wyoming Principal of the Year by the Wyoming Association of Secondary School Principals. Crisp was recognized in particular for his leadership and vision amid a rapidly changing academic landscape. KHOL's Will Walkie caught up with Crisp to talk about how he's been handling a near return to full in-person learning at the high school and his plans for the coming school year.
Principal Crisp, thanks so much for talking to KHOL.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
I'm wondering just first of all, your first impressions of opening back up to that four-day week schedule and everything like that. How's that been going?
Overall, I can tell you with strong confidence that I feel like our return has been a positive thing at the high school. Initially, yes, we had some very initial nervous energy around that shift. I think that's a completely natural reaction. However, a few things I think it's really noted to say, William, that really helped us. Our high school has been engaged with using what they call a learning management system for about 8 years now. We're one of the first high schools in the state to use an LMS. And what that essentially allows a teacher to do is post all of their assignments and interact with kids in a digital format. That was in our school already. And also coupled with that, our school had run what we call a blended learning program prior to COVID. And what that program allowed students to do is have options on when to attend face-to-face teaching based off their immediate needs versus being required to go every day regardless of their needs. When we had to shift, when COVID hit, it was, I won't go as far as to say it was easy, but it was much more seamless for us than I think it was a lot of other high schools across the country.
Can you just speak to a little bit on how you've been able to, despite going back to more in-person classes, try to keep everything safe at the high school for those that are immunocompromised?
For the entire year, we've had a virtual school option for students to take classes at a distance. That's a very important model piece that we provided options for kids. So if a student was gone, was sick, ill, or had a county order, they could still connect with their teachers and fellow students. I was in several rooms doing observations and evaluations where I would see the teacher taking their iPad and setting it into a group of three or four students. So one student's at home working with the three students in the classroom in real time. So they didn't miss a beat. Not a perfect system, but better than most people could have imagined.
I'm curious if you've witnessed a kind of reverse culture shock of sorts from people going back to like, wow, we're kind of getting to the point where it's starting to be back to normal.
So that's a great question. I think I can answer that question like this. I hope that we just don't all say, let's go back to the way it was completely. Most hybrid type systems that work, they work because students have choice to take them. When you force a hybrid or blended system on a student, no matter who they are, you generally are going to have those that do well and those that don't do well. So we've learned a lot about that. And I hope we can acknowledge as an educational system that maybe not every kid needs to have the exact same model all the time. We want to make sure that we take some of the lessons we've learned and we apply them going forward, fully realizing that some students do need that traditional structure. But I would hate to see us lose some of the things that we've learned that provide students with flexibility at the high school level.
I'm curious as if you can speak to a little bit of your success, but also just the school district's success in general, into what it was about you and your staff this year that was able to keep a level head and remain successful despite all the different variables being thrown in your direction.
First of all, just speaking about the Wyoming Principal Award, I'm only as good as my staff in our building, and I'm only as good as the community and student support that I have. And that starts with our superintendent and our Board of Education. And that trickles down. And so that is a fundamental reason that I'm in the position that I'm in. We have a lot of work to do here at Jackson Hole High School. We have a gap of learning that I do not want to see increase. When I say a gap, we have a very strong academic population here that does very well. And we have a population that needs extreme supports to be post-secondary ready. It is our goal here to continue to lift everyone. Our staff, too, have just really gone through a lot. And I think it's very important to recognize that. I know our new Secretary of Education at the national level will be doing a lot of work on the teacher profession, raising the teacher profession, and acknowledging the amazing thing that teachers have done across the country during the pandemic. So I'm excited about that.
Principal Crisp says he anticipates that Jackson Hole High School will return to one of its pre-pandemic blended scheduling models next year to allow for the maximum number of options for local students. Will Walkie, KHOL News. The release of the initial data from the 2020 U.S. Census last week made one thing starkly clear for Wyoming. It's a regional outlier. The Cowboy State has one of the lowest population growth rates in the country, while it's surrounded by several of the fastest growing states, including Utah, Idaho, and Colorado. But does Wyoming even want to grow? KHOL's Kyle Mackey reports.
Wyoming's 2.3% growth rate, which ranks 44th in the country, got a lot of attention on Twitter when the first batch of the new census data came out. Marion Orr, the former mayor of Cheyenne, is one of the people who weighed in.
You mentioned on Twitter that there's kind of like an anti-growth framework in place in Wyoming. I wonder if you can just expand on that and what barriers you think there are to more growth in Wyoming.
Well, I've always said that, to be very frank, I think the state could get out of its own way. We've put some real fences up around attracting certain businesses. For example, again, with Cheyenne and its Wild West roots.
Orr says she would have loved to bring a casino to Cheyenne during her tenure. That's an industry currently restricted to the Wind River Indian Reservation in Wyoming. She also says the state interferes with local control by restricting things like the number of restaurant and liquor licenses available. And then there's the constitutional limits on incentives that Wyoming can offer to businesses interested in relocating to the state.
Our forefathers, you know, really, I think, wanted to make sure that, you know, we weren't, I wouldn't say overpopulating, but that we were being very cautious with growth.
Another, quote, elephant in the room that Orr says is generating revenue in nearby states like Colorado is legalized marijuana, which the Wyoming House of Representatives declined to even debate in March.
It makes you wonder kind of, okay, well, then what are we going to do?
Orr served as a Republican mayor, but Democratic State Representative Mike Yin of Jackson feels similarly about how the state is impeding growth.
If the policies end up reflecting the idea that Wyoming doesn't want more people in it, then it means that we don't want more of anything else in it either.
Both Yin and Orr also stress that Wyoming's slow growth is directly tied to its over-reliance on the steadily declining fossil fuel industry.
If I had a nickel for every time that I heard in over my past 30 years in government affairs, you know, about Wyoming's need to diversify the economy, I'd be a rich woman.
Yin says the core question is, what does Wyoming want? And if the answer is less people to share the wide open spaces with, that comes with consequences.
It means that you're not going to have as many opportunities in Wyoming. If you grow up here, it means it's going to be harder to stay here because we have anti-growth policies, right? So it'll be easier for you to find some sort of job or work someplace else, especially if you're interested in starting a family.
Yin also says it's clear that other states in the Mountain West are doing better than Wyoming at providing those opportunities while capitalizing on their access to the great outdoors. Utah led the nation between 2010 and 2020 with a population growth rate of 18.4%, and Idaho came in second at 17.3%. Will Froelich, the mayor of Victor, says that didn't surprise him.
I think Idaho is appealing for a lot of reasons, you know, the connected to nature, the beauty that it has, you know, Teton Valley, Idaho, and the people come through here, they're blown away. You get a lot of really creative people to move here. Our restaurants are amazing. You know, our small businesses, our entrepreneurship is all there. You have all these really interesting, talented people trying to figure out their way.
But with rapid growth also comes challenges. Victor, like Jackson, is facing such an intense housing crisis that Froelich says even the city is having trouble hiring new employees. The mayor also says he worries about how to preserve Victor's small town vibe that helps attract people there in the first place.
Do you want Victor to grow is a very tricky question. You know, when I moved here, we didn't have a stoplight. You know, we didn't have a lot of the stuff we have now. And I don't think the question is, you know, do you want Victor to grow? It's how do you want it to grow? Growth is inevitable at this point.
Yet another tricky subject for the whole Idaho region is the influx of remote workers during the pandemic. Both Froelich and Yin say they're not necessarily opposed to that kind of growth, but say that they want to make sure the newcomers become part of the community and don't just exploit it. It's also the more detailed state-level census data that Yin says will provide a better picture of what's happening here locally. That information is expected to be published by mid-August, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Kyle Mackey, KHOL News. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Jackson Unpacked on KHOL. I'm News Director Kyle Mackey, and this is our weekly show featuring reporting and interviews on local and regional news, music, and culture. Jackson Unpacked airs Wednesdays at 7:30 a.m. and Fridays and Sundays at 12:30 p.m. And you can also now listen to the show as a podcast on your favorite podcast app. Coming up next is a regional story that comes to KHOL through the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Collaborative.
The Bureau of Land Management is investigating vandalism at Birthing Rock, a petroglyph panel in the Moab, Utah area, estimated to be at least 1,000 years old. The vandalism included the phrase "white power" scrawled over anthropomorphic figures. The BLM Utah office says vandalism and graffiti erase the important stories of indigenous people who came before us and are still important to the spiritual and cultural lives of living indigenous communities. Molly Marcello of partner station KZMU in Moab, Utah, spoke to former BLM Moab archaeologist Don Montoya about what he calls a crisis in destructive behavior.
Don, thank you so much for speaking with me today. You and I actually spoke a couple years ago in 2019 about graffiti and vandalism on public lands, and it was sort of in the context of more of it seems to be happening with increased visitation. So I'm curious if you thought we were approaching some sort of crisis, and feel free to interpret that phrase however you want, but you know, when it comes to destructive behavior at archaeological and cultural sites.
Going back to our conversation a couple of years ago, I put it in the context of social media, that these sites were more apparent to the public because they're brought forward through social media context. And you know, that was my thought at the time. But reflecting back, I think it's more complex than that. Given what's happened in the last couple of years, you know, we're approaching a crisis, and the crisis isn't necessarily rock art vandalism. The rock art vandalism is reflective of something else. It's more symptomatic. And I think it's symptomatic of the social unrest that we have. You know, we're going through right now a lot of social unrest from the COVID-19 pandemic. The economic uncertainty, ideological polarization as well. The damage, I think, is you know, reflective of these issues and people acting out. It's more than just some of the rock imagery damage in the past. You know, Tom loves Jane, you know, with a heart around it. People ignorantly, you know, putting their names on the rock. It's much more complex than that. So I think it's emblematic of, you know, what's happening in society. Rock art is an easy target.
You know, you said we've always had bad actors. Do you also include people who have shot at petroglyphs or, you know, individuals or even institutions that have participated in looting by, you know, stealing remains and other items at sacred sites?
We can drill down deeper in that. And this is just a social commentary. There were people living here before 1847. And I don't think that's realized. You know, people come over the mountaintop and they don't see big, large cities and villages, you know, and make the assumption that nobody is there. We'll just take it. You know, it's part of our cultural history of manifest destiny. You know, that's what we're fighting is you know, the institutionalization racism. It's just not having a cultural sensitivity. And I attribute a lot of that to ignorance. Ignorance is lack of knowledge. You know, people that don't know that can be taught. If you're ignorant, you can still learn. And it goes back to, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, place naming, for example. We just passed a bill this last legislative session to take a look at place naming of Native American archaeological sites. Actually, they're geophysical sites, they're map sites. So there was a bill that was passed this last legislative session, you know, to get USGS the process of changing place names of derogatory Squaw Peak or Squaw Park, and make it easier to address the bureaucracy that it would take to make place name changes. And issues to yet to become forward. You know, for example, you know, the naming of Fremont Indians. There's no tribe that has an affiliation with Civil War General John C. Fremont. You know, and yet we've got place naming of people associated with him. You know, that further disenfranchises, you know, the Native peoples.
It sounds like these issues are bigger than one person scrawling a racist phrase across a petroglyph site, but perhaps those actions are symptomatic of a larger illness.
Yeah, and I think we need to address the illness and treat the symptoms, of course. But the symptoms are not causal. They're not the cause.
Don Montoya, former BLM archaeologist in the Moab, Utah field office. The federal agency is offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or people responsible for vandalizing the Birthing Rock petroglyph panel in the Moab area.
The Biden administration announced Monday that it plans to start reuniting some families who were separated at the U.S.-Mexico border under the Trump administration. At the same time, the White House has been struggling to handle large numbers of migrants arriving at the southern border, which some experts say can be partially explained as a seasonal pattern and also as a result of myriad factors in Central and South American countries. One family with ties to Teton County, Idaho, was part of the ongoing influx at the border. In our last story today, KHOL's Spanish language correspondent Alicia Unger reports on how their experience shows that some families are still getting separated during crossings to the U.S. We'll first hear news director Kyle Mackey interview Unger about her work in English, and then the full story in Spanish.
This Sunday is Mother's Day, and you've been reporting a very powerful story of one mother who was recently reunited in Teton County, Idaho with her daughter. Can you tell me about this story?
Yes. Many women that immigrate to this country go through a very difficult time in their country. And that's the main reason why they immigrate. And this specific lady, which we will be calling her just by her first name, her name is Jasmine. She's from Venezuela. And for many citizens of that country, they're experiencing a very difficult time right now. So her daughter came first to the United States many years ago and started residing in Teton County. Therefore, the mother didn't see her for over 5 years, as she told me. And looking for a better life for her young son, who is 20 years old, Jasmine decided to risk her life at the age of 60.
So as you mentioned, Jasmine recently arrived in Teton County, Idaho. Can you tell me about how she got here?
They crossed the border through the river in Texas. And once they arrived, they were arrested and they seek for asylum. I understand after talking to a lawyer expert on immigration, people get divided. And if they have somebody who sponsors them, they will be able to go with their families who reside legally here in the United States. So Jasmine had a daughter who lives in Teton County and went and picked her up. However, because they got separate, she could only pick up her mother, and her son is still in a detention center in Mississippi.
And so are they both now seeking asylum here?
They both are seeking asylum. As I understand, only the daughter, which she didn't want to say even her first name. She is the one who has a little bit of the power to try to help her mom and her brother. But she could only do one at a time, and at this time was her mother. And they're hoping both now, Jasmine and her daughter, are hoping that soon they can reunite it with brother's son.
Some people may hear this and say, well, why didn't she wait to cross and have her daughter sponsor her here? Can you talk a little bit about Jasmine's motivation to come to the United States now?
Well, apparently the situation in Venezuela is unbearable for them. There is no work, there is no food. And usually what it calls my attention is that usually you don't see older people risking their lives. Most of the time it's young parents with young kids. But I guess, you know, again, she still have a son that is 20 year old. So having her daughter here in the United States legally with the possibility to sponsor her, they couldn't wait anymore.
And so I understand you were able to meet both Jasmine and her daughter this past weekend. Can you tell me what it was like to see their reunification?
It was very emotional because it's just very recent that Jasmine made it into Teton County. So her daughter and her are still trying to recognize each other and bond and hoping that they can get and rescue the brother out of the detention center and praying that he's not sending back. As Sunday is approaching Mother's Day, Jasmine's happiness is not going to be complete, as she said. She gained what daughter, but she's missing her son.
Well, thanks again for your reporting, and we will take a listen now to your full story on Español.
Gracias. Thank you.
KHOL, Noticias en Español, los saluda Alicia Anger. Miles de mujeres en el condado Teton celebran el Día de las Madres acompañadas de sus hijos este domingo 9 de mayo. Pero hay muchas otras mujeres que no cuentan con la misma suerte, especialmente las madres inmigrantes que buscando una mejor vida para su familia se ven forzadas a dejar la tierra que las vio nacer y a sus seres queridos.
Tenía 4 años, casi 5 años sin ver a mi hija.
Tal es el caso de Yasmín, a quien llamaremos solo por su primer nombre porque entró al país de forma irregular y teme ser deportada. A sus 60 años, Jasmine, madre de 2 hijos, nacida, crecida y educada en Venezuela, arriesgó la vida junto a su hijo menor para venir a Estados Unidos y reunirse con su primogénita.
Lo que me daba fuerza y es que yo decía, mi meta es reencontrarme con mi familia.
Buscando salir de la crisis económica y de seguridad que se vive en Venezuela, cuenta Yasmín, desafió al peligro junto a su hijo de 20 años y ambos se enfrentaron al miedo cruzando al río Bravo, que divide a México de Estados Unidos. Sin imaginar, exclama Yasmín, que también su corazón quedaría dividido tras cruzar la peligrosa frontera de la madre naturaleza.
Me separaron de mi hijo.
Hace poco más de un mes, asegura Yasmín, tuvo la suerte de llegar al condado Teton tras salir de un centro de detención en Texas en el que cuenta estuvo semanas con el alma en un hilo.
Te llevan a un reclusorio, de ahí ya tú no sabes qué va a pasar con tu vida ni qué hay, o sea, ahí definitivamente te quitan tus documentos.
Cruce y separación de miles de familias sin documentos que no da tregua.
A los hombres lo ponen en la intemperie, en un sitio de verdad fuerte. A nosotros las mujeres con niños nos mandaban a celdas donde te daban una cobija.
El abogado en inmigración Trujillo informa que muchos migrantes han optado por esta práctica buscando una reunificación familiar a pesar de los sacrificios de llegar a una ciudad fronteriza, azotada por la delincuencia y exponerse a perder la vida.
Que han intentado cruzar el río o pasar por desierto, que tuvimos lastimosamente casos donde personas casi murieron ahogadas en el río por intentar cruzar.
Trujillo indica que el incremento de personas que buscan cruzar la frontera ha sido exponencial durante los últimos 4 meses.
Uno de los estudios que se hicieron hablaba de casi 8,000 personas por día que estaban tratando de entrar o de procesar para que puedan entrar.
El abogado de inmigración explica que los migrantes actualmente ven una flexibilidad en comparación a la pasada administración que comenzó la acción legal denominada Título 42 para negar la entrada a los migrantes sin darles la oportunidad de ir a corte a apelar sus casos de asilo con la excusa de la pandemia, ignorando que la presente administración también continúa ejerciendo esa acción.
Se ven personas que tienen problemas de nutrición, que tienen problemas tal vez recibiendo atención médica. Entonces, es parte de la preocupación que se tiene.
Tras noches de angustia, Yasmín corrió con la suerte de llegar al condado Teton al contar con el patrocinio de su hija, quien es residente legal de Estados Unidos, consiguiendo de esa forma el tan anhelado abrazo de su primogénita. Pero la felicidad de Yasmín asegura, este Día de las Madres no será completa. Y solo le queda aferrarse a la esperanza de volver a ver pronto a su hijo menor, quien permanece en un centro de detención en Mississippi.
Yo le digo a mi hijo, sé que vas a salir de ahí, mi amor, y que nos vamos a reencontrar como familia.
Alicia Anger, KHOL, Noticias en Español.
That's it for today on Jackson Unpacked. Original music for the show is by the local band, Strumbucket. Tune in for Jackson Unpacked live every week, Wednesday mornings at 7:30 a.m. and Fridays and Sundays at 12:30 p.m. You can also now listen to the show as a podcast on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your shows. Subscribing, rating, and reviewing helps us keep bringing you local news, music, and culture. So thank you for your support. I'm Kyle Mackey. And this is KHOL Jackson.